This is an interview with Curtis H. Barnett for the SEC Historical Society's Museum and Archive of Financial Regulation. I'm Robert Colby. Today is May 21st, 2013, and our interview is taking place at the offices of Littner, Deschler, and Littner in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Mr. Barnett, thank you for being with us today.
Robert, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you and to have this interview.
Oh, well, that's great. Let's jump right in with early life and with your talk a little bit about your early life. You're born in St. Albans, West Virginia?
Yes, born in St. Albans, West Virginia, on a family farm property that had been in the Barnett family for some 200 years. Very interested in high school athletics, very interested in life saving and water safety. Spent most of my early years as a lifeguard, teaching life saving and water safety. My father worked at Union Carbide, and my mother was a teacher.
Okay. And what took you to the West Virginia University?
Well, different actions caused me to head to Morgantown. I was a high school athlete and a very good student. So I had scholarship opportunities to go to several different colleges. West Virginia was the home state flagship university, and several friends and relatives had gone there. The Benedum Foundation offered a modest but very nice scholarship, and I think a combination of recommendations and financial assistance caused me to go.
Okay. What sports did you play, if you don't mind my asking?
No, not at all. Football, basketball, okay. And baseball.
Did you play any at West Virginia?
I did not. Okay. I was advised in high school, my senior year, that accepting a football scholarship at 167 pounds would be suicide, and that I shouldn't do it. And I mulled that over. And one other college in particular was of interest, but so I concluded not to be or attempt to be an athlete at a place like West Virginia, which even then played big time athletics. Now, I was very active in intramural athletics at the university, mm-hmm. particularly in basketball.
When entering, what did you think you were going to study, or what did you plan to study?
From the outset, believed that it would be political science or history or a foundation course that would ultimately lead to law school.
Okay.
Like many college freshmen, I was certainly unclear about what I ultimately mm-hmm. wanted to do, but I had a lasting sense, and to this day, that it would be some combination of teaching, public government service, and something in the private sector, sort of those three mm-hmm. intersections of mm-hmm. Interests. Mm-hmm. And so political science and history, there was a professor or two early on that caused an interest and pursued it from there.
Okay. And you said you always had law school sort of in the
yes.
in your sights, because you thought that would further the sort of career you were talking about?
I had a grandfather who was the town squire, and my grandfather Robinson was certainly influential in that regard. I was always very interested in government leadership, public service, political office. Was a candidate, successful candidate for those offices in high school. It seemed that lawyers in adult life often were those who led in those mm-hmm. political, certainly in our state of West mm-hmm. Virginia. So it seemed a logical career path.
Okay. but you ended up on a Fulbright scholarship. How did that come about?
Well, I was fortunate at West Virginia to have an excellent academic record, was elected to Phi Beta Kappa, mm-hmm. Fortunate to have a good military record, mm-hmm. and was a cadet colonel, a commanding officer of the ROTC program. was also the president of the student body. Hmm. So those recognitions, if you will, achievements sort of came together, and it made then one eligible for consideration of a scholarship like mm-hmm. the Fulbright or the Rhodes. But the Fulbright was a 1 year, and I had then been commissioned as an officer and had no deferment at the time mm-hmm. I was applying for these scholarships. And the Fulbright was a year, and I could get a deferment for a year. And so ultimately that was the decision. Now, two professors were particularly helpful and influential mm-hmm. in the decision.
And you studied international law?
Yes.
At
Manchester.
Okay.
Yes, under two very distinguished professors, a Professor Wortley and a Professor Ballot. And Derek Ballot went on to become a secretary at the United Nations, a very distinguished scholar. The two West Virginia professors, a Brit named John mm-hmm. Williams, and the department chair, Carl Fraser. So I'm eternally grateful to them, to the four professors, as we all have professorial mm-hmm. reasons for our success.
And you did this looking forward to a career in law after the Army?
Teaching law, government, public service, mm-hmm. still the three.
Okay. Sure.
And I'm sure, Robert, if I looked over my applications mm-hmm. to different institutions, organizations, it would simply repeat those three
sure.
possible interests. So, yes, the Fulbright okay. Very, very much supported that, and the study of international law was an excellent foundation. I had a hope and a reasonable degree of confidence that when I did go into the military, I'd be going into military intelligence and hopefully as a counterintelligence corps officer. And, of course, the study of international law mm-hmm. would have supported that.
Which is where you did find yourself.
Yes.
I never know how much you're allowed to talk about military intelligence,
well,
but I'd be interested to hear your career.
Well, I can talk a little about it, but in some respects not okay. very much, even today. But the year plus that I spent in England, and I've completed a diploma degree mm-hmm. at Manchester, but a young lady that I had known and dated, we were not engaged, mm-hmm. but dating seriously, West Virginia, Joanne Harner, and I were still of interest to each other. So when I came home from England on the Fulbright and went into the military mm-hmm. at Fort Holabird, Maryland, in the intelligence school, we had serious discussions about marriage. Mm-hmm. And so clearly my interest was, if I could, was to get assigned back to Europe. Mm-hmm. And she was interested in joining me mm-hmm. in that. So that's what happened.
Okay.
And that is part of the military intelligence story. But I was trained for 6-7 months at Fort Holabird, Maryland, as a counterintelligence corps agent, mm-hmm. and then went to Germany, just outside of Frankfurt, mm-hmm. To serve for the remainder of my service for a couple of years.
Okay.
As an operative agent, mostly in plainclothes in Germany, and working with some of the most capable and dedicated, often trilingual, quadrilingual agents that one can imagine, had an enormous positive impact on mm-hmm. In my interests and in my career.
What brought you from there back to Yale?
The continued interest in attending law school, mm-hmm. but it was very close.
Okay.
The program exists today, and I believe it's a matter of public record, and I believe I can talk about mm-hmm. it, but there is something called the FAST program, Foreign Area Specialization Training. It is a remarkable program. If selected, mm-hmm. you would finish a master's degree at a university mutually agreed upon foreign country. You would then go to the foreign country and work for 3 years or so in a State Department type position. You would then return to the university and finish your PhD, and then return to the country on assignment again. And then after that second foreign country assignment, would go into your assigned career. We thought very, very carefully about the FAST program, and yet starting to raise a family, long-term interest in law school, decided to realize that sort of lifelong interest in going to law school. Now, the challenge we had was that we had never visited any of the law schools, but we'd asked a number of people, and I have one mentor in particular, and I should have mentioned earlier, Dr. Irvin Stewart was president of West Virginia University, and his son, Richard, was a year ahead of me in college. Dick was a Rhodes Scholar and often talked with me and advised about the importance of going abroad to study. But also, he went to Harvard Law School. And the two law schools that I heard most about, other than West Virginia, were Harvard and Yale. A very distinguished professor at West Virginia had gone to the Yale Law School. So I knew a little about both of them. So here we were sitting in Frankfurt, Germany, applying to law schools that we had not visited. And we sort of did it just ranking the schools and applied ultimately to Harvard and Columbia and to Yale. Fortunate to be accepted to all three, but we decided upon Yale, part for a serious substantive reason. The scholarship assistance was more, and we very much needed scholarship assistance. It was a little closer to West Virginia, where our family still lived, and we joked often that in the student housing literature, it advertised student housing on Lake Place, which we were certain overlooked a beautiful lake in Connecticut. And, of course, it was a very bad street behind the Payne Whitney Gymnasium. But nevertheless, we decided to pack up and head for New Haven, which we did.
At Yale, did you focus on a particular kind of law or have mentors?
Very general. Probably the most general undergraduate legal education, contracts and torts and civil procedure and estate planning and taxation, but early decided an interest in the litigation, the dispute resolution process, and I was fortunate to win the Thurman Arnold Appellate Competition Prize in my first year. Became very active in moot court and quickly decided on the teaching, if I had an opportunity, wanted to teach, and became then, if you were still a student, you were called a research assistant at the law school. So I did that. Additionally, had transferred my intelligence interests to something, again, which I think it's okay to talk about, but at many major universities, there are located what are called SIDs, Strategic Intelligence Detachments, and there was such a detachment at Yale, 441st Strategic Intelligence Detachment, focused because of the expertise of a professor in that particular part of the world, in this case Burma, Laos, North and South Vietnam, Cambodia. And a small 7-person unit. I was very fortunate to get assigned to that. So I was sort of teaching and going to school and serving in this unit, and then ultimately I got part-time jobs with law firms who needed research done to in connection with cases. So that's sort of how law school was spent.
Sounds incredibly busy.
It was very busy. And Joanne had a couple of jobs as well.
Mm-hmm.
Our fun part, we were both in, she in a sorority and I in a fraternity, so we occasionally chaperoned Yale social events. And, they were a little different than West Virginia.
So did you, were there particular professors who mentored you? Or?
Oh, sure. Okay. Sure. Very much so. The then associate dean of the law school, Jack Tate, was, in our experience, was memorable. The dean, Eugene Rostow, professors Elias Clark, Richard Donnelly, James William Moore. These are all mm-hmm. legendary. Boris Bittker,
mm-hmm.
legendary names in the profession and textbook authors in their chosen fields, but mm-hmm. all were just, and many others. I don't think there's any single one, but cumulatively, the half dozen or so were very, very influential.
How did you, what brought you to Wigan and Dana after?
The question in our minds was whether we should return to West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
That was our home, our parents, my family in mm-hmm. the Charleston area. Joanne's family in Morgantown, home of the university, and should we return to West Virginia to practice law
mm-hmm.
and run for governor? That's the student body president's always ambition. It's almost your duty to go back and be governor. And Joanne made it pretty clear that it was either her or being governor, that she really didn't want to get into an uh-huh. elective. And I'm joking, overemphasizing, but it was
sure.
It was partly true. We didn't want that for right. our life. But nevertheless, we went back to West Virginia, and I worked one summer in West Virginia with a wonderful law firm. In fact, mm-hmm. the firm's name is Steptoe & Johnson, and my youngest son, Jim Barnett, is now a partner in that firm in Washington, D.C. It's a different firm from the West Virginia firm now, but it was an interesting coincidence. But we spent a summer there. It was a great law firm. Certainly, if we had stayed in West Virginia, if we'd been given the opportunity, we would have worked with Steptoe, but we conclude we did not want
mm-hmm.
to return to West Virginia. And then the question was where? And it caused us really small town people,
mm-hmm.
and we wanted to live in a smaller community. And as I started applying for interviews and jobs, Wigan and Dana, a firm that's counsel to the university, a very prominent regional firm mm-hmm. then and even more so today, interviewed immediately. They interviewed the first week of law school and made a job offer and said, you have 2 weeks to accept.
Mm-hmm.
We're making an offer at UVA, at Harvard, and Yale.
Mm-hmm.
Three positions. And we talked about it, and we, Jen and my wife and I talked about it and decided that New Haven is a small town.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great place to live and to mm-hmm. we're raising a family then.
Mm-hmm.
And to raise a family, let's give New Haven a chance mm-hmm. until we get our lives stabilized. And so maybe 3 to 5 years and look at it again. So we accepted the position. I was in a law tutor teaching at the Yale Law School. By then I was a commanding officer
mm-hmm.
of the intelligence detachment. And those helped, having mm-hmm. those two additional sure. associations and joined the firm.
Okay. What kind of work did you primarily do?
Litigation.
Litigation.
Litigation. Litigation.
Okay.
A lot of insurance defense work, minor criminal defense work, but representing Yale professors and students, a little domestic relations work, but just a broad general mm-hmm. litigation
okay.
practice. Some corporate work, but very limited.
Do you find it helpful later to have that broad experience?
I do, and I don't mean this immodestly, but I've said it publicly and in talks, and because mm-hmm. I believe it. I believe that a good litigator can do anything because you're taught how much you don't know and the consequences
mm-hmm.
of not being well prepared and not seeking knowledge and assistance. If that's your discipline, then working in the corporate area It's not easy, but it's achievable because you're going to do your homework, you're going to get assistance. And I think that's certainly what happened in my career. I started as a litigator and moved into the corporate. Mm-hmm. Never lost my interest and attachment to litigation, but I found it a relatively easy entry.
So what caused you to make that entry? You were Wigan and Dana for 5 years?
Mm-hmm.
What took you from there to Bethlehem?
We drove regularly from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, uh-huh. to West Virginia, to Morgantown and to Charleston, St. Albans. And we had friends in Bethlehem, Steele,
mm-hmm.
Who would often say, "We'll stop by and say hello." But ultimately, the invitation was that Bethlehem Steel is a great place to live. Bethlehem, a great place to live. Bethlehem Steel, a great company to work for. Have a growing law department. And would you consider joining Bethlehem Steel as an mm-hmm. attorney? In several years, I never didn't even give it a second thought. But there came one discussion that we decided to at least stop as a courtesy mm-hmm. and talk to people and interview. And that caused 5-6 return trips to Bethlehem just to look and consider and think about mm-hmm. and talk. And in our family, you may ask, well, why did you finally decide to go to Bethlehem? And my answer to that often is because of the Tappan Zee Bridge, because we were probably the sixth time we'd just been to Bethlehem, that wonderful visit, and going back to New Haven. And we were literally driving over the Tappan Zee Bridge, and Joanne said, well, what did you think of the visit? And I said, wonderful people, it's a great company, and I can't wait to get back to New Haven. And she said, I understand, that's really interesting. She said, what do you think you'll be doing in 5 years? I said, well, hopefully I'll be practicing at Wigan and Dana and trying important cases and hopefully still associated with the law school and maybe have moved up to full colonel in the intelligence detachment. I mean, mm-hmm. look forward to it. She said, that's wonderful. And we drove a little further, and she said, what do you think you'll be doing in 10 years? And it was the same answer.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, you ought to think about that. You ought to think about that.
Hmm.
I said, what do you mean? So we'll contrast that with Bethlehem Steel, international operations, wide travel, diversity of work within the legal field, a whole host of very different opportunities and experiences. That caused us then to decide, and it was a substantial compensation increase,
mm-hmm.
but that caused us to decide to try 3 to 5 years at Bethlehem, and recognizing that that might not work out,
mm-hmm.
and if so, we'd move back to Connecticut. So it was a trial of a 3 to 5 year experience.
You said it was a growing law department at Bethlehem. Was there something driving that growth?
I think several things drove it. The increased size and complexity of the company, international operations of the company,
mm-hmm.
the legal issues facing the company, all of those were happening in the late 60s and the early 70s. Francis Van Nuys was then the general counsel, and Francis was a member, and we'll talk more about it. Again, I will be interested in whether you've even ever heard of it, but there is a group called the Association of General Counsel. At that time, it probably had 60 members. They were the 60 most prominent general counsel of the leading companies in the country. Met twice a year for several days, and they truly shared the best practices, the efficiencies of operating a corporate environment.
Mm-hmm.
The trend, which seems commonplace today, was to bring all lawyers in a corporate entity together into a corporate law department and function as a law firm within the company. That was not true at Bethlehem Steel, and generally it was not true in corporations with exceptions. And the exceptions were those who were on the cutting edge. And what had happened in the corporate world is that lawyers were hired functionally and vertically. So if you were the vice president of accounting and responsible for taxes, you hired tax lawyers. If you were the research officer responsible for patents, you hired patent lawyers. If you were the corporate secretary, you hired a corporate lawyer who knew about SEC kinds of things. If you, and you can go on. So what had happened at Bethlehem, and it was very representative of corporations generally at that time, was that there were many lawyers in different, six, seven different departments within Bethlehem, many of them from substantial New York City law firms, principally Cravath, but attorneys that for one reason or another really wanted to have their careers and raise their families other than in New York City. But I think a majority of the attorneys at Bethlehem, certainly when I joined, were graduates of a New York law firm in Prince Cravath. So Mr. the vision was, the trend then was for the leading companies, and clearly within the Association of General Counsel group, which is not a public organization, you won't ever read about it, and it exists today, and I'm proud to be an emeritus member today. But I think the teachings from that, and then the opportunity, I had an opportunity to be part of that. No question that was part of the reason for joining, to see a great company bring together all its professionals in one organization. Easy to say, but very difficult to achieve, because people have grown up vertically, they're independent, they work for a different officer, and they may or may not have an interest in consolidating under a general counsel or chief legal officer. But clearly that's where the efficiency and the effectiveness was.
So were you hired to be in this newly consolidated legal department, or to work for, in one of the, originally to work in one of the branches?
I was hired to be a part of the general counsel's office.
Okay.
And Mr. Van Nuys, the then general counsel, may have had, pick a number, a dozen, 15 attorneys, general in their scope, who reported to him. But the corporate secretary did not, the patent attorney did not, the tax counsel did not. They were independent. The vision was to bring them together. And it took years to achieve that. And, but the same thing was happening in other companies. I will not name them, but the same thing's happening in the other companies.
So when you started, was this consolidation a project of yours, or were you primarily dealing with other things?
No, I was practicing law, serving as a division counsel to several divisions of the company, and litigation, and investigation, internal investigations, criminal defense, some corporate, and then a division, counseling of several divisions of the company. That's, but with a particular interest, informal, quote, assignment to watch the evolution of the corporate law department. And that's what really interested me, in addition just to my normal practice.
So what were the primary issues you were dealing with at practicing within the company at that point?
Oh, the I think the adjustment, the family move, family adjustment, working within a corporate environment as opposed to a law firm environment, having in effect one client as opposed to multiple clients, learning about the company, learning the business of Bethlehem Steel. Those were all major challenges.
And as you moved up within the department, did your responsibilities change?
Yes.
As you went from attorney to general attorney and then assistant general counsel, how did your responsibilities change?
They changed more with the administrative responsibilities and the assistance in the hiring of new attorneys, the supervision of new attorneys, but then the very case case-specific responsibilities. The title that you carried often identified you within the company and externally as having the authority to speak for the company, speak for the general counsel, and your clients. And I haven't thought recently about the specific assignments that were changing over that period of time, but clearly the major cases, the major investigations that I was a part of, and often the attorney in charge, that's the concept we use, not title, not general attorney, you could be a brand new attorney, be the attorney in charge of a particular project, but there were a number of those.
Okay. One of the issues in corporate governance at this time is the corporate scandals ranging from the Penn Central bankruptcy to the domestic and foreign payments. Did was that an issue that you had to confront working in the?
I think the general Bethlehem was a very compliance oriented company. Mm-hmm. I think its officers truly believed in doing the right thing and complying with the law, and it made it relatively direct to implement process and procedural changes that were directed by the outside environment. And I think we were always on a learning curve to try to adjust our internal concepts and practices to meet what's happening in the outside world.
With the reforms that the New York Stock Exchange instituted with the internal controls and things like that, did you find that was something that was easy to comply with or difficult?
I think that all of the accounting issues, all of the internal control issues, we had Pricewaterhouse as our independent accountant. We were fortunate to have just a rigorous internal audit system. So I think it was not major change that took place. It was only enhancement because of new directives, new requirements that internal procedures or practices be changed, modified, made more rigorous. But it was not it was time consuming, it was expensive, and often thought unnecessary. The change was adaptable.
Okay. One of the other major issues in the 1970s for a lot of major companies was shareholder proposals, and was that something that you ever dealt with?
It was not. We had shareholder proposals. They tended to be the proponent regulars, the Evan Y. Davises and others. When we had a serious, meaningful, constructive shareholder proposal, we negotiated those. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we hoped our objective was to go to an annual meeting with zero stockholder proposals, and we regularly did that. On the other hand, if a stockholder had a proposal we just believed was fundamentally wrong, and they tended to be the professional gadflies, if you will, the stockholder, we would oppose those and routinely defeated them.
Can you give me an example of what, like, the constructive proposals that you dealt with were? Or
I think the answer generally is no, because they were so so elementary. It may have had to do with the place of the annual meeting instead of mandating that it be in Wilmington, making it flexible.
Okay.
It may there were just good common sense, why didn't I think of that, sort of thing. But but not really. Again, other than the ones that we routinely opposed, there was another side to even those.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
that we opposed.
Sure. you continued to, so in 1976, you became Vice President, General Counsel, and Corporate Secretary. Was that all at the same time, or was that?
I became Assistant General Counsel and Corporate Secretary first.
Okay.
And then that was upon the retirement of Robert Sonneman, a very well-known corporate securities lawyer within the corporate world at that time, who had been at Cravath, and I believe he retired in 76.
And he was the corporate secretary before you? Okay.
And to my pleasure, but to my surprise, was advised that I had been selected to succeed him.
Okay.
And that started a different orientation in my experience and work life. But, and then Mr. Van Nuys retired within the next year or so, and then I became general counsel.
Can you tell me a little, you said it was a reorientation when you became corporate secretary. How was that?
What had happened in the early 70s, Bethlehem became very interested in diversification. And a team of three officers, our vice presidents of planning and finance and accounting, were the three corporate officers, and I was selected as the attorney to work with that group. So that's a fairly high-profile group within the company, and we did a number of acquisitions. Well, that meant working in the corporate SEC world, for sure, which I had done for then prior to Mr. Simon's retirement, had done for several years and had done quite successfully and had good reviews by the other officers. So I think that opportunity, which I thoroughly enjoyed, that opportunity helped prepare for possibly becoming corporate secretary. But once you are formally the corporate secretary, and it's tough. You can see a bylaw definition of a corporate secretary, but I believed, and today believe, that a corporate secretary should be the chief corporate legal officer for corporate affairs. Should be the officer responsible for board and committee agendas, liaison. Certainly should be the Securities Exchange Commission, the SEC filing and preparation. And I perhaps continued old-fashioned view, because of that prominence with the board and the interest of efficiency, effectiveness, I still think consolidating the corporate secretary with the title of general counsel is a good idea. It's one person. Now, the general counsel can have then an assistant general counsel who is in charge of litigation, an assistant general counsel who really is a corporate law attorney, and have other assistant general counsels. But I think it provides a sort of consistency and consolidation and board relationship and stockholder relationship, financial community relationship. It's very efficient.
What did you, so can you tell me a little bit about your responsibilities and the sorts of things you had to do as the corporate secretary were?
Sure. I guess first, if you go right to the organizational structure, it would be all of the relationships and the work with the board of directors, a major responsibility, agendas, minutes, meetings, speakers for board meetings and for the committees as well, preparing all of that work. Second, all of the corporate transactions, because you were then, at least within Bethlehem, Steele, you were the chief corporate attorney,
mm-hmm.
Transactional work, M&A work, all of that would be your
mm-hmm.
responsibility. The attendance, at least in our tradition, a corporate secretary attended all board committee and executive management. Different chairmen had different, there could be an officer group or a management mm-hmm. group or an executive staff, but whatever the internal group, the corporate secretary attended those meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And the general counsel might or might not, if a different person. Those are some of the principal responsibilities. So you're really at the heart
yeah.
of the leadership and the governance of the company.
Mm-hmm. And so serving on the acquisitions committee and then as the corporate secretary was mm-hmm. really your introduction. Was that your introduction to the world of corporate governance?
I think so.
Okay.
You're on the outside of that world when you are involved in litigation
mm-hmm.
or criminal investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the need for law compliance or you see where something might have gone wrong, but it's a more narrow focus than
mm-hmm.
the whole corporate,
yeah.
the whole entity, the whole enterprise.
So entering that world, what were the major things that you were dealing with as corporate secretary and then I suppose also as general counsel in this time period?
Well, substantively, the issues, I think the issues facing the general counsel, and this line gets blurred,
mm-hmm.
Robert, between what's general counsel and what's
mm-hmm.
corporate
sure.
secretary, but the issues facing you are the issues facing the client.
Okay.
I guess it's the best way to respond. And those issues had to do with the competition facing your
uh-huh.
company, both domestic and international. By subject matter, significant issues involving international trade.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the nature of the steel product, the environmental issues
mm-hmm.
associated with the making, shaping, and treating of steel.
Mm-hmm.
A steel plant is a very complex workplace,
mm-hmm.
so the Department of Labor and other regulatory authorities over
mm-hmm.
the workplace were very, very significant.
Okay.
The diversity of the workforce was very limited, and issues about the rights of employees. The whole United Steelworker, although in Bethlehem Steel's case, because we had multi-businesses and shipping and
mm-hmm.
railroads and transfer
mm-hmm.
and mining and so forth, we must have had, I'm guessing, a dozen different unions that we had
mm-hmm.
associations with to negotiate labor contracts
mm-hmm.
and work rules and so forth. Those are some of the...
That's quite a full plate.
It's a full plate.
As I understand that a lot of your time was spent dealing with the trade issues, the trade agreements
mm-hmm.
and things like that. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. The steel industry, if you think of it, let me digress, and I'm not sure how familiar you might be with the industry, but it's important to have that background like,
mm-hmm.
to understand the trade issue. The steel industry is both, of course, domestic and international.
Mm-hmm.
The domestic, the United States steel industry, during the time we're talking about here, was privately owned by stockholders.
Mm-hmm.
It was the world steel industry, nearly universally, was government-owned or government-subsidized. The American market, just for ease of description, requires about 100 million tons of steel a year. And that goes up and down,
mm-hmm.
but that's a good, easy thing
yeah.
to remember. So the domestic producers are generally capable of furnishing nearly all of that. And if that market goes to 120, which it ultimately did, the domestic producer is still able to produce only 100. So if you think of it in simple terms, it is a 100 million ton market for domestic producers, total of 120, and imports taking up the 20. But what happened repeatedly through, and continues today, is if conditions in a foreign country, unemployment, the easiest example, poor economy, the government simply cuts the price of the product since it owns the business and dumps that product into the U.S. market. So if something is being sold here for, pick a number, 500, and they can sell it in at 300 or 400, of course a customer, some types of customer, short-term customers, are going to buy that. So that's overly simplified was the story of the trade issue. And you had a domestic industry with a very competitive product that simply could not compete with a foreign government which subsidized its industry or which permitted the dumping, selling here at less than value or less than the cost to produce. So the industry, and not just steel, but industries generally, came to associate together as companies and associate with their unions. And they spoke with one voice. Now, that's all against our trade policy, which basically has not changed today. I had the privilege of being appointed by President Reagan, then by President Bush, George Bush the 41st, and by President Clinton. And I served in a transition under President Bush the 43rd. But, you know, moving from the Ministry of Commerce of the United States to the President's Trade Advisory Committee, and that's the key committee made up of businessmen, a small group, 14 to 18 people, and I served on that for 14 or 15 years. Our job was to advise the administration, the special trade representative, and the president about the issues facing our industry and our country against the trade policy. And the trade policy is very, very simple. And I believe if President Obama were sitting here today, he'd say, yeah, that's it. Trade markets, there are 4 points. Markets should be open. Trade must be rule-based. Trade in an open market and trade that is rule-based must be fair. But if the rules are broken, trade is unfair, the rules must be enforced. It's just that simple. Now, the debate over is enforcing the rules. Which do you enforce, and do the facts warrant enforcement, and so forth. So that's that was the environment that we faced, massive dumping, which in turn caused reduction in operations, which in turn caused massive layoffs and unprofitability. The steel industry is an industry in which whether you sell a ton of steel or not, your costs are largely fixed. You can't turn the light switch on a blast furnace. You can't sort of shut it down. You can't shut that massive equipment. Even if you do, phase them down, your employment costs, your pension, your health care costs under your labor contracts, the severance and the layoff. So, in effect, you must keep operating, and you must operate, hopefully, profitably. That, I'm sorry it takes so much time, but overly simplified, that's the trade issue.
And
we were very successful in implementing the trade policy. And particularly when you got to the fourth point, if the rules are breached, they need to be enforced. And we brought in a number of cases, dumping cases and subsidy cases and other cases.
It's interesting how much that relates to the other, you know, the labor issue, which is another one that you're having to deal with because it they're just so tied together.
Yes.
One of the things that, I was struck by in doing some of the background research is the negotiations of is the negotiating labor contracts and some of the different give and take that happens in that.
Sure. Well, I was surprised in 1988, the then chairman and the board requested me to serve as chairman of our negotiating committee, labor negotiating. That's the committee has a the company has a committee, the union has a committee, and I didn't aspire to that. I didn't volunteer for it, but once we talked about it, we had had a developed a tremendously positive working relationship with the steelworkers on trade issues. And testified regularly together before Congress, met with all presidents in the White House routinely on these issues. And the thought was that if we could bring that sort of positive approach to our contract negotiations, maybe that would be, jokingly, if you had someone as your chairman who was totally inexperienced in labor negotiations, that would be a secret a secret weapon. And I said, well, sure, I'll give it a try. But I have a very different approach to issues like a labor negotiation, which in my methodology is just like any other kind of negotiation. You identify what the issues are, and you put them on a list, and you work through them, and on a schedule. And so that's the way I went to Pittsburgh. And I have to tell you, the first few days, I think they thought I really did not know what I was doing because it's not a it's not traditionally a disciplined process, but we insisted, and the group I had, particularly Jack Klutz and Bob Westerman and Dorothy Stevenson, really experienced first-class labor people who theretofore had handled these discussions, were enormously supportive, and we negotiated, and the steelworkers finally said, okay, we want Beth and Steel to be the lead negotiator for the industry in this, and we developed our contract and became the pattern. For the industry. And you see, pattern bargaining from the union standpoint is essential because you have 40 or 50 companies all competing. If you permitted one company to have a substantially different labor contract with cost advantages, it would be very much to the disadvantage of the other companies. So they always contended they were doing the industry a favor by keeping a level field, and you know, one can debate that. But so we completed those negotiations, and I promptly went back to other responsibilities.
Well, in looking at some and maybe this was a negotiations that you weren't involved in, but I thought some of the specifics, in exchange for some short-term savings in labor, giving stock advantages, or I believe at one point I believe the unions got to put a director on the board.
Well, that was a part of the negotiation, and it was one of the last issues negotiated. And our position on that, and there are letters confirming this, but our position on that was that if the union wished to recommend someone for our board to consider, the same way we considered every other candidate, would go to, we can talk about the process, but would go to our trustees, directors, committee, There would be an investigation. There would be interviews. Mm-hmm. If the committee recommended, it would go to the full board. Mm-hmm. But it had to go through that process.
Sure.
That they could make a recommendation, mm-hmm. and we would, in good faith, consider their recommendations. But at the end of the day, it had to be just an exemplary individual mm-hmm. who would bring credibility to the board.
Did that often did you find that they generally put forth individuals who were?
In our case, I don't want to breach confidences, but sure, there were early recommendations that were not satisfactory, okay. but they did go through the process. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I received a phone call from the president who asked what I would think about considering someone who was the principal lawyer for General Electric and J.P. Morgan. Mm-hmm. And I said, Mr. Williams, you're sounding better all the time. So it turned out to be Lewis Caden.
Okay.
It was a partner of Davis Polk. And Henry King, a friend, Yale Law School friend, was then either the senior partner or could well have been the managing partner. I promptly called Henry and asked if I could come and visit with him, which mm-hmm. I did. And I told him what had happened mm-hmm. and that I did not want to move anywhere unless it had Davis Polk's mm-hmm. approval and unless he, Henry King, said yes. He is mm-hmm. the type of person who should be considered. And, of course, the firm made an exception. Normally, partners in law firms don't serve on corporate boards. But because okay. because Mr. Caden is such an exceptional person, and this was really
precedent-breaking,
they agreed he could be interviewed
okay.
And submit his application. So from that, Lou went through the process, but he turned out to be just an outstanding director, and he continues today. He's one of the directors who's continued right through the purchasing of the Bethlehem Steel assets and mm-hmm. Continues today as a director of the Mittal okay. Corporation.
There's some of the other things that...
Other companies had different experiences, mm-hmm. I must tell you, with mm-hmm. who ultimately came on their board. But from a governance standpoint, we believe strongly and had Mr. Caden confirm before our directors that while he was recommended by the steelworkers, once he became a director, his sole objective was the overall best interest of the corporation, mm-hmm. not the steelworkers. Mm-hmm. He had to discharge the fiduciary right. duty of a director, and, sure. and he did.
Sure. How similar is that process to the normal? That's the normal process
yes.
for directors.
Yes, okay. It is.
Okay,
it is. Directors, at least annually, sometimes I think ongoing, but at least annually, is a director self-evaluation, which is discussed, mm-hmm. And we talk about ourselves. There is a discussion of the board and the needs. Mm-hmm. of the company, really, the needs yeah. For advice and direction. And there was a very careful review of the demographics, the existing demographics of the board, mm-hmm. Discussions about potential candidates or sources that could be discussed with to identify potential candidates. Mm-hmm. It's a thoughtful I recommend, you'll see in one of my talks, I think that the chairman of the director's committee, the independent director, and the CEO should separately meet with and talk with each director during the year, mm-hmm. privately, often over a lunch before a board meeting yeah. or after any, but sometime, right. and talk about, how are you doing as a director, Robert? And mm-hmm. what changes do you think should be made? And who do you recommend we consider? So it's an ongoing process. And we were fortunate to have just an exceptional group of individuals.
Mm-hmm. How did, one of the things that I was interested to ask is how did, there's some reorganization of the business, mm-hmm. The different businesses within Bethlehem
right.
Steel. Did that have a governance impact, as different parts were, I don't know if I want to say spun off, but I would think that that would change certain things about how the business, how the board maybe looked at the company.
I'm not sure I understand your.
I just question. Didn't know if that had. I didn't know if the if the if the, with the different parts.
Well, you either are or you are not part of the Bethlehem Steel organization.
Okay.
You either are or not an employee of Bethlehem or a subsidiary. If you are, there's no change.
Okay.
All the rules apply.
Okay.
All the standards, all the procedures, all the codes, all the all apply. The business difficulties, I'm not sure, you know, where we are in chronologically where we are in the interview, but with some great degree of difficulty on the personal human basis, and something had been discussed for some time before becoming chairman, but within the first year after becoming chairman, we had 6 or 8 underperforming divisions, and they were not and did not have the prospect of performing satisfactorily, so very publicly, publicly to the community in which they were located, to the workers, the families. So we just simply said, look, this division is underperforming, and we have 3 possible actions, and sequentially we're going to follow each one of these, and we need your help, steel workers. We need your help, ship workers, railroad workers, pipe fitters. We need your help. We are going to try to improve the division, and here's our recommendation or plan to improve, maybe capital expenditure, maybe change in a product mix, but a plan. The division president had a plan to try to fix it, and we'll try to do that over a 1 to 2 year period. If we can't fix it, then we will sell it. And if we can't sell it, then we're going to close it. But that took several years to implement that. Now, throughout all of that, you know, were there tremendous organizational challenges and issues and disputes and confrontations, some successes and some failures, but the governance we had not one single stockholder litigation. We had no direction litigation against our board. We had no major investigations from enforcement agencies. So I think the integrity of the corporation held.
Okay,
even though we're going through some very difficult times.
I guess jumping back a little bit into the '80s. I don't know how much of an impact these two things had, but I was curious about whether tender offers and hostile takeovers were at all an issue. Was that something you were dealt with?
They were an issue.
Okay.
Always a concern. And we were absolutely prepared for them. We had, as many did, retained what was recommended to us by none other than Cravath as the leading firm and the leading person to help and work in those, and that was Joseph Flum of the Scadnarps firm. And Mr. Flum personally had acted as counsel for Bethlehem, came at my invitation to Bethlehem and spoke to our board and management from time to time. So I think we were prepared. I probably should not go into the specific details of particular issues that we face, because some are public.
We were talking about tender offers and
we were very well educated, very well ready. I guess that's the best way to describe it, from the legal defenses, from the training of our officers, particularly the chief executive officer, and how to deal with the phone call or the letter or however a matter might have then to deal with it, unless it was an offer that was meritorious and should be seriously and thoughtfully considered because it'd be in the best interest of the company to consider it. The then difficulty, and we haven't talked about this, but early on arriving at Bethlehem, I was assigned to assist and then also became the attorney in charge of major civil and criminal antitrust litigation, and became very active in the American Bar Association, was elected the counsel of the antitrust section of the American Bar. That's sort of corporate, as well as litigation. Yeah. It's about economics. It's about business combination. I hadn't thought of that. That was some introduction into the real corporate world. But the antitrust hurdles in consolidation with an industry like steel in the 70s and the 80s was just not possible. Today, in the 90s and 2000, it was just happening everywhere because of the efficiency and the need for doing it, but not in that era.
Okay.
So the the likely successful acquisition of a Bethlehem probably was not going to come from another steel company, at least another domestic steel company. But we were, I guess the best answer, Robert, we were ready, and we were always concerned.
One of the other issues at that time that I'm curious about is when the New York Stock Exchange moved to end the one share, one vote rule, did that have any impact on Bethlehem?
No.
Okay.
No, and it's still a subject of interest today because you have so many different stock structures within companies, and I know it's an often debated governance issue as well, but you look at the classifications of stock in some of the high-tech companies, or the New York Times, or the Washington Post, and I've given some thought to that, and it ultimately is a matter that just has to be resolved by the state legislature.
Right.
They create the corporate ability to do these kinds of structures. It's ultimately going to be determined by the, by the original equity founders of those companies. And these are the terms on which we'll invest and the terms on which we have been successful. So, but some of the voting power and the classes of stock are just remarkable. But it was not an issue for Bethlehem Steel.
Okay. Something else. It's during the still in the mid 80s that you served as the chairman of the Society of Corporate Secretaries.
Yes.
How did you come to be involved with the society?
Because the day that I met with Mr. Sonneman, who was my predecessor as secretary of Bethlehem Steel, he had several recommendations. And on that occasion, one of his first recommendations was, you need to become a member of the Stockholder Relations Society of New York City. And I hope you've heard of that. And the second, you must become a member of the American Society of Corporate Secretaries. Okay. And he explained what they both were. The group in New York is very informal. It's a group probably of 35 companies, so far as I know. It still meets monthly. And they're the corporate secretaries of the major of the major companies. The society, of course, is a different organization. So I said, yes, of course. And I believe Bob maybe went to the first meeting. Ben Rollins was a former corporate secretary of United States Steel. And as a fellow member of the industry, Mr. Rollins took me somewhat under his wing. He also happened to be a member of a hunting and fishing club in the Poconos, where we have a cottage, and Mr. Rollins had a cottage. And so Ben really introduced us and then recommended me for assignment to the Securities Law Committee, I believe it was called.
Yeah.
And then once on that, was interested in the work of the society, mm-hmm. and became involved and ultimately was elected chairman.
With the Securities Law Committee, did you deal with the SEC very much? Mm-hmm. What were some of the things that you were dealing with them on?
Just no single thought about this kind of question. I don't think there was a sort of a single burning issue as much as it was the overall advancement of governance of the corporation.
Okay.
And the constant debate between self-governance and regulatory governance,
mm-hmm.
And we can talk more about that
because I
continue to believe that we probably have enough laws, and we mm-hmm. probably have enough regulations, and the tradition in our country, when a scandal erupts, is to need to fix it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you fix it immediately is pass a law. Mm-hmm. If you have it, you appoint a committee, have an investigation, seek an indictment, and pass some new laws and regulations. That's just mm-hmm. the way we deal with major issues. And sometimes, arguably, that may be necessary. Often it is not. Often we probably have the laws and the regulations already in place mm-hmm. if they had just been enforced.
Right.
And I continue to believe that when we face major issues, that there is a process that can be followed. And mm-hmm. the first point in the process is defining just what the issue is and what the existing laws and regulations are that may deal with that particular issue, and then measure the facts of the incident, the scandal, against those existing laws.
Mm-hmm.
The next step, though, is to say, well, is this something that once illuminated, once thought about, once disclosed, that companies, as companies, can develop their practices and procedures to mm-hmm. deal with it.
Yeah.
And if it's in a industry, regulated industry, can there be self-developed protocols or guidelines or practices or procedures that can be imposed? Can best practices be mm-hmm. identified? And let's give the world a chance to go
right.
through that process. If that fails, then, and time has to pass, I understand mm-hmm. that, so the crisis is not being
right.
Beaten up on us all, but if that fails, then what's the minimum regulatory
mm-hmm.
Process, rules, that could be adopted, and then maybe you get to mm-hmm. federal legislation.
Sure.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But that should be the last. Of course, our process, once there is a truly major mm-hmm. issue, is you just collapse all of that
right.
and you do it. you do it overnight.
Yeah. So I'd be interested to hear a little bit about your time as chairman of the Society of Corporate Secretaries. What you had that experience was like?
Well, excellent. Obviously, an excellent board of directors. Many of the corporate secretaries were also general counsel.
Mm-hmm.
So they were chief legal officers. A number of them were members of the Association of General Counsel. Many went on to, you know, very distinguished careers.
Mm-hmm.
But the society, as a society, provided this tremendous opportunity to get to know other corporate secretaries, not mm-hmm. only in your industry, but across the spectrum of industries, to learn truly what the best practices were that you could take to your company.
Mm-hmm.
There was an educational part of this, and there was a way to get to know the whole regulatory authorities in a way where you both had the common objective to try to understand what the issues were and figure out ways to deal with them. And that's I found, for example, that representatives of, then in government, both the SEC, the Department of Justice, the Federal Trade Commission, they were very responsive to participating in meetings, general meetings of the society or committee meetings of the society. Gave you a chance to hear their issues, hear their concerns, make yours known to them. There, of course, was some traveling involved in that, but it was a very, very significant opportunity.
Were there people at the SEC you remember working particularly closely with?
I looked recently at a list of people at the SEC. Now, for Bethlehem Steel, as general counsel, as secretary, most of my really professional work association would have been with branch chiefs or assistant branch chiefs at the SEC. But at the commissioner level, at one time or another, probably starting with Al Summer, certainly with Rod Hills, and Rod is someone new and respected at the commission, and his wife is a longtime personal and professional, Carla. She was a trade representative and a graduate of the same law school.
Okay.
Ed Fleischman came to know Ed in a number of different contexts. David Ruder as a friend, a professor. Richard Breeden knew. Curtis Arthur Levitt, and was requested to, it was a somewhat challenging assignment to testify before the Levitt Commission and basically opposing the timing of more than the substance of what he was trying to do in some of his accounting regulatory reform. But I came to Harvey Pitt, Harvey Goldschmidt, Bill Donaldson, Chris Cox. Those are all folks over the years that I've known or had some association with. But the working association would have been at a very different level with the branch chiefs and assistant branch chiefs. And there, the challenge I always found with the SEC, but the same is true in the practice of law generally and before the court generally, is establishing your credibility. And if you can establish your credibility, your integrity, then you will have the precious thing you desire most, and that's just access to get your issues heard and get them dealt with in a timely way. If you don't have, you're in the midst of a filing of some sort, trying to seek a clearance of some sort, if you can't get access, and if people don't know your background, your integrity, then you're at the mercy of a big regulatory agency.
It's critically important to build those relationships.
We work very, very hard to establish our credibility and integrity with the agency, with the commission and the commission staff.
And
at the lowest levels to the highest levels.
And the society is important in that.
No question.
Right.
No question. Okay. No question.
We can move on to your discuss becoming chairman and CEO.
Yeah.
Was that something that had been planned advance?
No. Okay. No, I don't think so. succession planning at Bethlehem was a very orderly process, and something that, in my experience with several chairmen, because I was the general counsel and the secretary as a part of it.
Right.
The process and the planning of the process. No, Mr. Williams was the chairman and CEO, and had indicated his plans to retire. The board went about a very orderly process of considering both internal and external candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And as that process emerged, several individuals had discussions with me about whether I would mm-hmm. be a candidate for this. And I thought about it and measured it against what the challenges were facing the company. And what I concluded was that, yes, I would wish to be considered, but only if two of the three, really, three in existing internal officers could be a part of the team of mm-hmm. officers that would then lead the company.
Okay.
And one was Roger Penny, who was the operations person, a terrific steel plant manager, and who I envisaged as the president of the company and the chief operating officer, Gary Millenbrook, the financial officer, and I envisaged as the CFO, Jack Jordan, as the administrative officer of the company, chief of staff, in fact. But I saw a way that if that team of people mm-hmm. could emerge, sure, I would be the chairman, the CEO, but within the context of mm-hmm. working with these other officers. But I thought that was something that I would consider and would be able to do. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that's what happened.
Now, law background is not normal for
Robert,
for the steel business.
You should do your homework.
Is it?
In regulated industries, it is more common than is thought.
Interesting.
At U.S. Steel, Chuck Corey, a lawyer, had been CEO.
Okay.
Prior to that, Roger Blau, partner at White & Case,
mm-hmm.
had been chairman. And then you can jump to the other industries. David Good of Norfolk Southern, Chuck Prince at Citigroup, both Pfizer and Merck.
Okay.
The current CEO of Merck is a general counsel, Ken Frazier. So I thought often about that and written a couple of papers, thought about it. But what happens, two things happen, is that where an industry is heavily regulated,
mm-hmm.
the importance of the legal function is required. And then second, that person then becomes very viewed by the officers and directors of the company because
mm-hmm.
he's responsible for so many issues
right.
that are critical to discuss the
right.
company. So if he has an interest in higher management, it can develop. But certainly in my case, make no mistake, I could not have possibly acted in the operating and financial and environmental affairs areas without the leadership of these other officers.
Mm-hmm. Were there particular areas you found your background as the general counsel and your legal background helpful?
Yes. Yes.
Where was
national trade, labor, environment, healthcare, pension,
mm-hmm.
External affairs, testifying before Congress, meeting with members of the executive branch, and the financial community.
Mm-hmm.
Much of this is communication,
mm-hmm.
and organizing and public speaking and the analytical skills that you're taught
mm-hmm.
as part of your legal training are very helpful. A good litigator, you said before, the first thing you know is how much you don't know,
mm-hmm.
so you're just never hesitant
mm-hmm.
about getting help, and do not get in that witness chair unless you know what you're talking about. So you reach out. There's very little arrogance in humility.
Uh-huh.
And if you have that training, that skill, it's helpful.
Mm-hmm. the issues you're facing as chairman and CEO, are they pretty similar to the? They seem like they're similar to the ones that Bethlehem was facing in the '80s: the trade agreement, trade issues, labor. Are you dealing with the same things?
I think so. Okay. Different time sequences and different prioritization, okay. but the issue is the profitability of the company, the competition, competition both foreign and domestic, both fair competition as well as unfair competition, the increased prominence of the so-called electric furnace producers, the mini mills who made steel. They can make about 50% of the lower grade qualities of steel much cheaper because basic steel making is, I get only a lawyer could have this analogy, my steel experts tell me, but it really is a lot like making soup. And so what you put into a good soup is what you get out. And to make an integrated steel producer is someone who starts with iron ore and limestone and coal and turns it to coke and turns it to iron and refines it, and out comes steel. And this quality of the steel, the metallurgical mix of steel, is whatever you want it to be. If you're an electric furnace producer, you just take scrap steel, scrap cars, and scrap, and that's what you put in the furnace, and that's what you get out. So it permits you only to make about, in those days, about half, a third to one half of the range of quality products. What Bethlehem Steel was capable of doing was making the low-quality product, but they could also make Tiffany products because you put it in. You mixed it in. You made the soup to come out that way. But there was tremendous competition then by the electric furnace producers entering the market, and then the lower grades of steel could make it much less. So here you had divisions who were making in the 70s and the 80s, they were profitable. Today, with the electric furnace producers, they were not. So increased domestic competition, and then substitute materials as different forms of plastics is the easiest generic description, but composite materials, then they could substitute for different steel applications, and they became a real competitive threat. So I would put competition, dealing with competition, as a major issue facing the unprofitable divisions. What do you do with unprofitable divisions? How do you set? We had talked about it. We had it in different pieces, but we realized we had never really thoughtfully planning throughout the organization developed our mission and our objectives and our strategy and our values. We had a strategic plan. We had an annual financial plan, and that's just part of it. But we had never, in fact, Carol and Jack Weber, professors at the Darden School at the University of Virginia, guided us through that process. So just remarkable. I've used them often, recommend them often. Got us through that as a company, all levels, through our... That was very important to go through that because what it told us was that we needed to focus on our core business. And we make steel. That's what we do. We're not in the coal mining business. We're not in the shipping business. We're not in the railroad business. We need to do what we do best and concentrate. We need to be the premier steel company. That's what we need to be. So that was a real challenge. Concurrent with that, we still had all the issues of the environment, with issues related to healthcare and pension issues, not unique to Bethlehem. All mature manufacturer companies had the same issues. Automotive had it, cement, it would go through the list.
You need a great deal of litigating before the ITC also.
Yes.
A lot. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, the ITC is an independent international trade decision-making body. The these are generalizations mm-hmm. now, but often the petitioner, the plaintiff, brings an international trade case, and it winds up between two different agencies, the Department of Commerce and the International Trade Commission, mm-hmm. and they each have responsibilities in adjudicating the merits of a trade dispute. But the ITC is just critical in that process. Now, unlike most litigation, in which at the end of successful litigation, the plaintiff wins a monetary judgment. Of course, in trade litigation, you don't.
Mm-hmm.
If you're completely successful, the measure of success is the imposition of a duty, a tariff,
mm-hmm.
on the party who's trading unfairly. And those revenues then went to the United States government. They didn't go to the mm-hmm. injured party. So that was the process. And to start a countervailing duty case or a dumping case or other litigation, you would often file and find yourself quickly before the International Trade Commission. Mm-hmm. It's a long process.
Mm-hmm.
A year and a half would be quick. But we engage in as an industry.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And generally as a co-petitioner with the steelworkers, often mm-hmm. the case.
And these cases come back again to what we were talking about earlier, the issues of government-subsidized companies and dumping and things like
mm-hmm.
that. It's this. You're just confronting them again before the ITC, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Different. You litigate by product.
Okay.
And by country.
Okay.
So it may be a particular product from Japan, a particular product from Germany
mm-hmm.
or England, or a particular steel product from a particular country. That's the way you
mm-hmm.
litigate. It's very product and very country specific.
Okay.
And the proof is very corporate, is very economic,
mm-hmm.
it's very antitrust. I sometimes say that the best training to be an ITC lawyer is to be a good antitrust lawyer, because it's all about economics.
Yeah.
It's all about understanding manufacturing process, sale process, cost of manufacturing,
mm-hmm.
those kinds of concepts.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very very lengthy, very uncertain litigation, and to some extent, very public policy influenced. Because witnesses routinely in these hearings would include either for you or against you people, elected public officials, people in Congress, customers, suppliers,
interesting.
Who have a vested interest in the outcome.
And
in our case, for example, Senator Spector, Senator Rockefeller, often, frequently, witnesses, a variety of congressmen, Congressman Jack Murth, I'm just thinking of names,
mm-hmm.
excuse me, come quickly to mind, at hearings would be very, very frequently a part of that process.
Testifying as to the effects of these trade practices?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Urging imposition of remedies, testifying the adverse effect on their constituents of unfair trading practices.
And you won a number of these cases.
Yes, very successful.
When you win a case, one of these cases, what happens?
Well, there's an appellate process, but mm-hmm. ultimately there is a final order, and the final order generally is the imposition of a duty, a tariff,
mm-hmm.
Against that product coming in. There can be some retroactivity,
yeah.
but that's a different subject, how far back you can
mm-hmm.
reach. But then prospectively, any product coming in that has been found to be dumped by,
mm-hmm.
pick a number, 10%, would
mm-hmm.
have a an assessment of that amount
sure.
against the product, which
okay.
had to be paid.
Okay.
And the collection of that would go into the revenue, U.S. revenue.
Okay. What were some of the other major issues that you were facing as chairman and CEO? Or are there other things you'd like to discuss about your time?
I really think Robert, we've covered most of them.
Okay.
Diversification within steel.
Mm-hmm.
We've not talked about that, and
okay.
We did make a major acquisition of the Lukens Company,
okay.
a very substantial plate mm-hmm. manufacturer in Coatesville, Pennsylvania, a very successful acquisition. The concentration on the core business caused us to continue to reduce non-steel core mm-hmm. parts of our business, but on the other hand, to acquire
sure.
a company like Lukens. Nothing comes quickly,
okay.
additionally to mine.
One of the other things I was curious about is to go back to governance a little bit.
Yeah.
You've now seen, in your career, by the time you're the chairman and CEO,
yeah.
you've been involved in governance as a general counsel, as corporate secretary. You served on the board from...
I was a director from 86.
And now as chairman and CEO, did your view of how governance or how corporate governance function changed as you took on these different roles?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I really don't think so. And I think there's a certain mystique about governance and who's responsible for
mm-hmm.
governance. And I believed from day one and continue to believe today that in any organization, the chief governance officer is the chief executive officer of the company.
Mm-hmm.
That's the chief governance officer. It isn't a staff person or isn't someone with the title of governance, I'm certainly not the general counsel,
mm-hmm.
And that the corporation that governs best, and to me it's the only way that you have a satisfactory governance culture and compliance, is if the culture, the practices, the procedures, the code of conduct, the education, we can talk about all that,
mm-hmm.
is such that each employee, one day, 20 years, each employee understands
mm-hmm.
that compliance, accountability, governance is my responsibility. I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm unsure, I need to pick up the phone. I
mm-hmm.
need to talk to someone, say, I've been asked to do this, or a customer wants me to do that, or Joe says I
mm-hmm.
should do it this way. But it's all very easy to say, I know that,
mm-hmm.
but until you have that sort of corporate value, it's all about a value system,
mm-hmm.
it's all about, and that's what you should hope to do. So every director has to set the example,
uh-huh.
every officer has to set the example, CEO has to lead it,
mm-hmm.
And then your code of conduct, if you go through the steps, and what we often forget is that the era of the 60s and the 70s was antitrust compliance long before code of conducts were ever heard of.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very rigid code that was developed in companies. It was because of the tremendous criminal enforcement effort
mm-hmm.
the Department of Justice on antitrust. So they're developed, in my first experience with corporate codes, was really with antitrust.
Mm-hmm.
Very detailed antitrust compliance guide,
mm-hmm.
A certificate that people sign for antitrust compliance, an educational program to teach people about antitrust compliance, an inspection, particularly the commercial and the sales offices. That's the era of the 70s. 60s and 70s. Well, along comes foreign payments and other accounting issues in the 80s, late 70s and 80s. Well, a corporate code of conduct, broad
mm-hmm.
corporate code of conduct emerges.
Yeah.
And antitrust is just a subpart of the corporate code then. But that corporate code, which it lays it out, and if you're a best practice company, certainly in the 80s, it was common
mm-hmm.
to have a corporate code, but it was of meaningfully It was the code. Then there was an educational required educational presentation of that throughout the organization.
Mm-hmm.
Certificates signed by employees throughout the organization, and understanding that if you have a question, this is who you call.
Mm-hmm.
So there's everyone knew where to go, what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the toughest part, often debated, is when there were breaches. There was known enforcement. If someone did not comply, their number was called and they were out.
Internal enforcement. Okay.
People understood that noncompliance has its consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Was that always the case? No. There could be some marginal actions. But where you have, and again, it was easiest in cases involving antitrust, easiest in outright fraudulent invoicing, steps like that. But you had to take action, and
mm-hmm.
you had to report it to law enforcement, and you had to prosecute it.
Okay.
And sometimes those are very, very difficult decisions because
mm-hmm.
It often would be easier to simply discharge the employee
mm-hmm.
and let the matter
sure.
go away. But once you do that, you've impaired your overall code, your
mm-hmm.
overall enforcement program, because you're telling people you mean it and you're going to enforce the rules.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't. This whole idea, it seems, I know in today's environment it may seem such old-fashioned, puritanical, but it's all about personal accountability.
Mm-hmm.
That's what corporate governance is all about. The corporation can't comply. The corporation
mm-hmm.
can't govern. It's the people. The corporation is the people.
And you got to build that culture, right?
Absolutely,
mm-hmm.
absolutely, and it's tough.
Yeah,
it's very tough. When I joined the MetLife board, there were issues involving sales practice compliance issues, and MetLife had a terrific corporate compliance program. But what they did was simply move the rigor of all of that to deal with this specific issue, to deal with sales compliance
mm-hmm.
and established a very, very excellent program. This was both under Harry Kamen, who was then chairman, and later under Bob Ben Moshe. And they did it in the right way. In the right way, I think, corporate performance as well as individual performance should
mm-hmm.
be done. They tied it not only to your performance, but to your compensation.
So I'd like to talk a little about the transition from being chairman and CEO to going to Skadden Arps.
Right.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you came to leave Bethlehem and go to Skadden?
Well, about two years. At about 2:30, I need to make a call. Maybe
okay.
this is a good time to make
okay.
it.
Okay, we'll take a pause. All right, so we were talking about the transition from Bethlehem to Skadden Arps.
Right.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
A couple of years before I retired, probably in 98, had initial discussions with the board and senior directors in particular about my wish to retire at age 65,
mm-hmm.
normal age.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked to reconsider that, given the issues facing the company, opportunities facing the company. I said, no, I will have been CEO for over 8 years. That's longer than anyone except our founding father. I think it would be an excellent time for change, especially if we can get some further things
mm-hmm.
accomplished, which we did. So that started in a really orderly process from the board standpoint and mine as well. And the advice, some of the best advice I've ever received was to start planning your retirement now.
Mm-hmm.
Don't wait until 6 months before you retire and involve your wife in the process, so which I did. And so we started our discussion, very informal and over time, but one decision was pretty easy: to return to the practice of law.
Mm-hmm.
A second decision was easy. I guess they all three were easy: to spend a substantial part of my time in volunteer, especially higher education efforts, and we can talk about that.
Sure.
And then the third, obviously some personal family travel time, divide your life into three segments.
Right.
And so the return to law part of it, both our sons are attorneys, and I had thoroughly enjoyed my years primarily as being associated with the law.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not appropriate while an incumbent CEO to really have discussions.
Right.
Either, I didn't think.
Sure.
But a number of firms, and ultimately three in particular, had discussions with me about possibly joining them. And I said that, please, for your sake and my sake, let me retire. And then promptly we can have further discussions and decide. So that was the process.
Sure.
It was against that kind of
sure.
process. One such firm was Skadden Arps. And we had a lunch in New York City involving Mr. Flum, Mr. Aaron, Mr. Rogan, a product of the SEC, in fact, and who I think has been interviewed early on some years back for this type of interview, and Ambassador Bob Lighthizer, then a Skadden partner, had been formerly an ambassador and very much involved in trade activities. I think there were four or five of us. And we had a discussion in New York, and they asked if I would consider becoming associated with the firm in D.C. And I was very flattered, and I said, you know, there is one major problem, and I've had no discussions, none, about this with my oldest son, Kevin, who was a partner at Skadden Arps, working in merger and acquisition. And I don't recall whether it was Mr. Flum or Mr. Aaron or something, and he said, don't worry about it. We talked to Kevin 16 months ago about this. Told him what our hope was, and he said, I think that would be wonderful. I don't think there's a chance that Dad will consider that. So and then the pitch was made, it'd be great to be associated with the same firm as your son.
Sure.
Kind of thing. So I thanked them very much. Returned home, thought about it, discussed it, of course, with Joanne, called Kevin, and he said, yes, Dad. He said, and if you join the firm, remember, you're going to be working for me. So that was very special. So that's generally the background. I expressed my thanks to the other firms, and most of them really understood, particularly given the family situation. But I believe then, as I think I said to you, and believe today, that it just, I was honored to be associated with the firm. It's the number one firm. I was at a retired partners meeting 2 weeks ago, and it still is. By objective, not by trying to make yourself feel good, but but by what people say about the firm and the ratings that the firm receives. So that's the background.
What sorts of things did you work on at Skadden Arps?
Broad corporate governance, M&A, legislative, just basically being a resource to respond to issues and partners' concerns, public speaking, one of the requests I made, which the firm is very supportive of, was to maintain my membership, for example, in the Association of General Counsel, Corporate Secretaries,
mm-hmm.
Business Council, Business Roundtable, organizations which I was eligible, though in a transition retirement, mm-hmm. and which I did and continue today.
You mentioned earlier that you testified on some of the auditor independence hearings. Was that while you were CEO, or was that at Skadden? Before Arthur Levitt?
Congressional testimony was all as a CEO.
But you said you testified before Arthur Levitt on...
Oh, that was prior, when he had his accounting,
uh-huh.
his regulatory
okay.
commission. The date? Give me a date on that.
2000? Would have been in the fall of 2000.
It was before that. It was in New York City. It was not before the SEC.
Oh, okay.
It was before the group.
Oh, okay.
He appointed.
I see.
Ira Milstein.
Oh, so the Blue Ribbon panel.
The Blue Ribbon
panel. Yes, okay.
That's what I testified
okay.
for in New York City.
Okay, I see. So that would have been 90, yeah. That would have been 98, 99.
Yeah.
Okay.
As CEO.
Okay. Well, I was interested...
Testified on behalf of the business roundtable.
Okay. Okay. And so I would be interested, you know, given that you were observing the governance changes of that came with auditor independence and Sarbanes-Oxley, mm-hmm. I'd be interested to get your perspective watching those unfold from the Skadden Arps perspective and just what you think about the changes in governance in the last decade or so, generally.
Well, how can I answer that?
Well,
I should
break it down.
Well, no, I should... And please, I should clearly speak here now as an individual.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Not for Skadden.
No, not at all.
I'm just speaking as an individual. When I look at the whole regulatory process, and it goes back to something we talked about earlier,
mm-hmm.
It's trying to clearly understand what the issues are. And then clearly understanding what the existing, you know, whether it's statute or regulation or accounting procedures that govern that sort of area,
mm-hmm.
and then trying to make an informed decision about, one, whether any change is necessary, but then if it is, what sort of change?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the, I was looking at, with which I agree, before you act in a regulatory environment, you need to identify the risk,
mm-hmm.
and then you need to determine the urgency of doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And then, which is not done well, figure out the impact of doing X.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, the resources you have to do it. That just repeats again and again in SEC
right.
testimony and literature. And I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I apply that to much of what has happened, or you can single out particular legislative changes or just as generalities, I find that we have often simply overreacted and overreached unnecessarily. Thereby complicating certainly the private sector ability to effectively, efficiently operate and govern. And the stories, of course, coming out of Sarbanes-Oxley and the stories coming out of Dodd-Frank are just, and they're still emerging.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that those were totally wrong? Or no, of course not. But were there some excesses in both? Absolutely.
Is there a particular, you talk about risk, urgency, impact, and resources. Is there a particular one of those that you think that they didn't measure well or didn't account for?
I guess this is so, so much since 2000, almost. I'm very reluctant to get very specific because it will become very company specific.
Sure.
As I get specific, and I shouldn't, I feel like I shouldn't do that.
Sure.
From a Skadden-Arps standpoint, right. I shouldn't do that.
All right.
That's maybe fun. I'm overly.
Well, that's fine. If you looking at corporate governance from the perspective, I guess, of your whole career, are there things that what are the main changes that you've seen, I guess, and where do you see it going forward? Those are big questions.
I believe that corporate governance has been and is today and will be tomorrow only as effective as the leadership that's provided by the chief executive officer, the officers, the directors of the company, and absolutely through their personal accountability set the highest standards of corporate governance, and that efforts, and this will sound critical, and I don't mean it that way, but efforts to sort of institutionalize corporate governance are well-intentioned, but the heart of effective corporate governance is just enormously personal. And unless the personal accountability, personal responsibility of individuals to understand and to comply with the rules of the road that affect their particular job, and to know, meaningfully know, where to go to get help, and a feeling that, it's okay.
Okay.
You make a phone call to the general counsel and say, look, I'm confused. I don't know what to do. What should I do?
Mm-hmm.
Or I hate to call you because I just observed Pete doing something I think wrong, and I don't know what to do. That sounds so trivial, but it's not. That's the heart of the successful governance system. Until that is, so you can have all of the appointed governance officers, you know, all the rules, all the regulations, if they just get tossed on the shelf without a meaningful educational program, without a very important inspection of compliance, and with consequences if you don't comply, and then wherever possible, actually putting, you know, we talked about it, but you know, I believe a corporation has its four constituencies, and you can, with metrics, determine whether individuals and whether the company as a whole are achieving their responsibilities to their stockholders, financial, to their employees, to their customers and suppliers, to the public at large. And you can put real subjective numbers behind those. And governance is one of those. How are we doing as a company? How am I doing as an individual in achieving compliance? What reported EPA and OSHA violations are there? There are ways of putting compliance right into the compensation program.
Sure. Okay. I think that pretty much covers everything that I have. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
Well, I think it's just going back to what we sort of started to talk about. And it's part of the governance foundation. I believe has to be built on a corporate structure of an enterprise that really understands what its mission is and its objectives and its strategy and its value system, and those need to be very, very widely and effectively communicated and educated and lived, most importantly. And with that, then I think in terms of governance, having your governance written products, the educational program to support them, the inspection, if you will, the verification of compliance, the certification of individual compliance, the consequences if you don't comply. Those are all critical parts of a governance of a governance program. Now, beyond that, I think issues facing corporations today are very challenging, and I think I would just we haven't talked specifically about this, but and these are just one person's view, but in today's, especially in today's environment, this whole the importance of something which other than financial institutions is relatively new in the last 5 to 8 years, this enterprise risk assessment is something that every company, large, small, private, public, should be, and it's more than financial risk, obviously. But I would put, if you were to ask what are the major, some of the major issues facing the corporate world today, I would put very high on that the importance of enterprise risk assessment, and it's true in colleges and universities as well.
What do you mean by enterprise risk?
Determining what the risks are that the organization is facing, your reputation risk, your credit risk, obviously, the risk of a major incident because of the business you're in, your liquidity. Every business is somewhat different. But what are all the things that our company, our business, our school, that's not something that you're going to find in a text or a piece of legislation somewhere. It's to look at your enterprise. What could go wrong? And identifying that, and there is now emerged, and if you, it may come up in your interviews. I hope it does, because enterprise risk assessment is directly tied to governance of the company. Unless you have effectively assessed the risks facing your enterprise, it's pretty hard to govern it. So a robust enterprise risk assessment and an enterprise risk plan to deal with possible incidents, risks that you may face. The second area, and it also ties directly to governance in spades, and we can talk about some examples, some are public and some are not, is management succession, especially CEO succession, because it's very hard to govern a company if you have a loss of a CEO by incident or medical without an effective succession plan that has been thought through. We hate to see old Hank go, but everyone knows, at least on an interim basis, and it's the interim emergency succession that's so critical. Every enterprise should have it, and some still don't, believe me. So enterprise risk, management succession, I guess it's the evangelical quality of our discussion, but this whole idea of just personal responsibility, personal accountability, it isn't something that they should handle. It isn't something they should take care of. I should do it.
Right.
That's my responsibility. I got to be a part of it. We talked a lot about trade. That, I believe, is as much a relevant issue today, fair trade, in accordance with international trade rules, is just as critical. And there's so much attention drawn today to executive compensation issue, which, again, I believe may be much simpler. And, but the solutions are ones that are often not to believe satisfactory, because if the business of the company is to be responsive to its constituents, and if the constituents are, as we've discussed before, your financial constituents, principally your stockholders, the financial community, if they are your customers, your employees, and the public, then a compensation system can be structured that discloses how you're going to achieve satisfactory corporate objectives that are responsive to those constituents. And they are not qualitative. They're quantitative. And the thing that, and I finally, another company, it's public, but I still won't, for some years, I have been privately outspoken, but in meetings have spoken, to the misleading nature of proxy disclosure compensation, and particularly the totally inappropriate articles and headlines on executive compensation, because the accurate measure of executive compensation is what we're taxed on. So what we should see in a proxy statement is W-2 compensation. We should see what the executive's actually getting.
Bring me the one you have.
And some are doing that only by voluntary disclosure. But what we're seeing are these massively inflated numbers that have nothing to do with what an executive gets in cash and what he's taxed on.
Can you give me an example?
Stock options.
Okay.
Stock award. They haven't even vested. So it would be so easy to have a system in which compensation is tied to responsiveness to the four constituents with qualitative measurements in a proxy disclosure.
So you're saying what's taxed is what should be disclosed?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
That's what you get. That is your compensation. It isn't the possibility that someday you may get a restricted share of stock, or it's not the possibility that your option today is worth X and someday it may be Y, or it isn't. You disclose the contingent possibilities. I'm not suggesting otherwise, but that the heart of disclosure and what we understand an executive gets is what the United States government thinks he gets. So I really give you an assignment, Robert. I want you to read a few proxy statements.
Okay.
And tell me how close you think they are to that executive's W-2. Now, can you find it through backing and filling? Yeah. But can you ever understand that in the headline in the local papers or the headline in local executive makes $30 million. Well, that's just false.
Well, executive compensation is just such a, and it always has been just such a contra, it's such a, it gets people riled up.
And the way to deal with it is to make it quantitatively determinable, and then an executive either has or hasn't. You can debate whether those are the right determinants, but I think If the stockholder financial is to increase the value of the stock by X, or if it's to pay a dividend of Y, but I mean very specific, or have a level of profitability, every company will be different. The financial measurement, reduce the unfunded pension liability by Y, very in the brokerage community, the investment community would agree with that. Yeah, those are the key issues.
Yeah,
for the customer. You know, it's X. It's quality performance. It's one-time delivery. It's quantitative. With the employees, it's probably more in the safety, workplace, diversity kinds of issues. And the public is really what we've been talking about, is code of conduct stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had problems with law enforcement? Have mm-hmm. you had litigation against right. you? and then that's public,
mm-hmm.
and you can debate whether those are the right measurements, but for each year you know whether someone has done it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do, then they deserve to be compensated.
Mm-hmm.
And the comp, you understand every little bell and whistle that someday contingent they may get, but he really got $1 million. And that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But he didn't get 30 million.
Right.
I really think, Robert, that's...
Okay, well, we covered a lot of ground today.
We covered a lot of ground.
Well, I wanted to thank you for agreeing to be in the interview, and it's been a pleasure.